from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. My name is Jacob Fortant. Today, I have a very special guest as we continue my Atheist Appreciation Month, which is, like any good atheist project, sometimes a little bit late. Yeah, that's a great sign, Jake, because we're just about to launch my Kickstarter campaign for the book. But I say better late than never. So I have an interview today with Guy P. Harrison, who is an author of several books that we're going to be talking about. They're rising in popularity, so it's a good thing I caught him now before he becomes a superstar. And he also has a degree in history and anthropology from the University of South Florida. He's here today because we're going to be talking more about him. Who is he? What's his background? I figured there is a lot about him on the net, but there's very little in terms of the kind of information that make a person stalkable. And that's what I want to do. I'm going to make him stalkable. So with that in mind, thank you for joining me, Guy.
Oh, thanks, Jake. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you, man.
When I had asked a bunch of people, when I was doing this Atheist Appreciation Month, I said, who should I interview? Your name came up so often that I had to secretly believe that you, everyone owes you a favor or something. You have like a gun. Like, everybody seems to love you. That's kind of like, that's the thing. Did you know this?
I'm just a likable guy, man. I'm just so positive and full of constructive and good skepticism. Nobody can resist my charm, I guess. I'm the good atheist.
Well, yeah, you're actually the good one. Well, I'm probably the crusty one. Maybe you should take my moniker. I'll sell it to you. You would fully admit the fact that you're not taking any position to try to deride or be mean, because I've listened to several of your interviews, and you always mention, you make it a key point to bring up in all interviews saying, I am going to be nice, but...
Yeah, that's the thing. I really do bend over backwards to be extremely nice to believers in anything, whether it's UFOs, gods, psychics, whatever. That's sort of my thing. I think part of it is just my personality. You know, maybe I have some deep-seated need to be liked by strangers. I don't know. Or maybe it's just that I kind of figured out early on that it's a positive and efficient way to navigate your way through life is to be nice to people, be kind. And on a practical side, I've found it's much more effective to be polite, respectful, and gentle when dealing with believers, because they have so much emotion tied up into their beliefs that if you come at them with your own emotion, it's just going to be a battle of wills and not much is accomplished. So I've found that if you sort of offer them a helping hand rather than just a slap in the head, you tend to get further. Now, here's the but. Okay, and I always emphasize this because I've been accused by some people of being too wimpy or too soft, but I completely disagree with that, because what I do is I calibrate the tone of my voice according to who is standing in front of me at a particular moment. So if I've got some little old lady who sends her money to Benny Hinn every month and she gives $20 to a psychic every other Saturday or something, then, you know, I'll sit down, I'll have a nice, polite conversation with her, ask her some questions, maybe get her to think in some different ways, make some suggestions to her, tell her some stories about my past that might open some doors in her head and make her reconsider her position. I'm definitely not going to call her an idiot or come on really strong, because one, that's rude, and two, it won't get me anywhere. However, if I've got Pat Robertson or some Al-Qaeda guy standing in front of me, I'm not going to be so gentle, because those people are directly destructive. They're embracing and promoting beliefs that are directly destructive to others. They're slowing progress in the world, and they're hurting people. So those people I tend to be much more aggressive with. So I think it's a case of, you don't have to be good cop or bad cop. You can be both, and you should be both. I always encourage every good skeptic out there, define your moment according to who you're engaging with at that moment. Define your attack. Don't be one-dimensional. Don't be a jerk all the time. Be a jerk sometimes when appropriate. Don't be a wishy-washy softy every time. Just be that when it's appropriate.
I wish that someone would actually write down the different stages of disbelief, right? Because I think everyone will admit that it's kind, you know, if you were once a believer, it doesn't just happen as a sudden thing. You know, I've talked to multiple non-believers now, past converts, and they just say, well, you know, it was a kind of it's something that I reasoned over time. I read some books, and it really just was an accumulation of things. So I think that in that sense, everybody's got stages, you know, where the like when you're dealing with death, the first reaction is going to be shock, or is it, you know, you won't accept it. So with non-belief, I think that maybe if we were actually able to do a bit of a better job at identifying those different stages, then we know precisely the kind of language, the kind of arguments, and the kind of passion that we need to be putting behind it in order to make that transition just sort of like even more fluid.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You're absolutely right. The typical scenario for an atheist is that the belief that they have sort of crumbles and erodes over time. It's like just reason and new thoughts just chip away at it. Just the winds of considering other ideas, they just slowly blow away this little sandcastle of belief inside your head. And all of a sudden, one day you wake up and, you know, you're living your life, and then you kind of, you go, hey, wow, I don't even believe in that stuff anymore. What happened? When did that change? And you can't even quite remember. You know, there's no road to Damascus epiphany. There's no big moment of glory. It might happen for some, but I think that's extremely rare. What's interesting, too, you're talking about stages. I think that most skeptics, most non-believers go through stages of attitudes as well, where as once you kind of figure out that all this irrational belief stuff is a waste of time and doesn't make any sense, you tend to be really arrogant at first. Not everybody, but many. You kind of think, I figured this out. Look at these idiots around me. Why haven't they? And then you kind of maybe mature a bit and you kind of realize, well, hey, I was in their shoes once, and you kind of mellow a bit. And then as time goes on, you might even reach another stage where you get really frustrated and you just get fed up and you almost want to say, well, to hell with this planet. These people are nuts. You know, there's no hope for them. And then you might go into another phase where you say, well, you know what? You've got to hold on to hope. Yes, my planet is insane, but I'll keep trying, you know? So yeah, there's no such thing. And this is difficult for religious people to comprehend, but non-believers, atheists, or it's a very complex, diverse group of people. You just can't really describe them in one word. Apart, you know, there's one thing, non-belief, that describes them. But beyond that, oh my gosh, it's so diverse.
Well, it's weird that we're kind of, at least for now, because we are a minority, are brought together by a negative.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, it's a sad state that there even has to be a thing called atheist. I mean, a thing, you know, well, why? I mean, you know, and it's such a big deal. Nobody, you know, as it's been said many times, nobody has to start a club for people who don't believe in fairies, you know. But the problem is, fairy belief isn't influencing laws and retarding science education in schools and, you know, hindering medical treatment around the world and all these things. So that's why there has to be this sort of atheist pushback, this movement of atheists. It's necessary. Guys like you doing podcasts, it's necessary because religion, although it does many good things, and most religious people are very good people, the fact is religion is extremely destructive throughout history and today.
Destructive in ways that are very subtle or perhaps not immediately obvious to people. I remember just yesterday I posted up a letter from a Jehovah's Witness mom who just basically wrote to her son saying, well, you know, I have to separate myself from you because you've made your choice, and you're welcome back if you just take Jehovah. So kind of like this false idea that she's kept the door open and not realizing that, you know, in the history of religion,
that's very consistent with the Bible. She's supposed to do that.
So that is what Jesus does say. He says that if your parents or your brothers and sisters don't believe, you're supposed to just leave them.
Yeah,
you have
exactly.
A new family now in this crazy cult. And that's not how they see it, of course, because we're kind of used to that cult, aren't we? Yeah. It's a bit too familiar.
No, you're right. I mean, religious belief hurts in many, many ways. It really does. But, you know, in America and Canada, places like that, I think a lot of people tend to ignore intentionally or just simply don't know how bad it really is, though, in many places around the world. I mean, every day I follow this stuff closely. quote, child witches, unquote, are abused and killed in Africa in the name of Jesus routinely.
Thing in sorcery in Saudi Arabia that you linked on your on your Twitter. Yeah.
Right, exactly. A man was beheaded for practicing sorcery. I mean, that's, you know, if he was doing that, you know, well, I'm sorry he wasn't more skeptical. And the people who felt he was committing some serious, horrible crime, I feel sorry for them because they're not skeptical enough to realize the whole thing is nonsense. And in India, people are routinely tortured and killed for practicing magic. You know, it's just so sad this stuff goes on. It's so much abuse of children and women. I mean, that's really just rampant in our species, and it's justified by religion. I mean, it might be just, you know, some would argue, well, it's just an excuse. They're using religion. They do it anyway. Maybe so. But religion, at least in this point in our history, religion is making it a lot easier for them to do because they get it, you know, written into laws and all kind of stuff.
Well, I imagine that we just have to kind of admit, I think, as a species, that skepticism is not a natural thing. You know, like our intuition about the world will often be wrong. You know, just a common example, I think I mentioned on one of my last podcasts. If the sun revolved around the earth, what would that look like?
Yeah, pretty much like it does, yeah.
Yeah, and there's only, and I use the example of Mars being that one outlier that brings into question that model. But even in that circumstance, you could have been skeptical and then still had a lot of quote-unquote evidence that maintained a belief that was untrue.
Sure.
And it's just because you didn't really actually realize that the evidence that you had was an improper belief to begin with, a Ptolemaic view of the universe, the assumption that was wrong. And I think that in religious terms, that's where it comes from. Like, we have wrong assumptions about the world and about our environment, and the skeptical part of us is just not natural. This is a new thing.
Right. And I constantly try to pound this into the head of atheists and skeptics that don't just associate this problem with intelligence or even education. I say because some of the most highly educated people in the world, most intelligent people, any way you want to measure it, are extremely religious. You know, they're not consistent in their thinking. They're very good skeptics who are religious. They just shut off their skepticism when it comes to the religion they were raised in. They're not consistent. Some of the best skeptics I've ever met in the world on Christianity are Muslims. Okay, they can rip the Bible apart. They can give me 50,000 reasons why belief in Jesus is not justified, but turn the spotlight back on Islam and the Quran, and whoa, it all shuts down, you know. And some of the best skeptics in the world on Islam are Christians. To sum it up in a nutshell, skepticism, I think it's number one, it's making the decision to think for yourself and be brave enough to live with the answers you find along the way when you actually think, challenge, and question extraordinary claims that are all around you. It's about courage. It's about caring, wanting to live in the real world and being brave enough to face that real world. That's what really matters. It's not so much how many books you read, you know, how many religious debates you attend or anything like that. It's just that first step of making the decision, saying, you know what, I want to live in the world, the real world. I'm not going to trust everything these people all around me tell me because I know they're not all right.
You also have to just think about the bravery in terms of how people perceive skepticism in the first place. We're supposed to be cynics or nihilists or something like that. Like, you don't believe in anything.
Oh man, I'm an optimist. And for me, the way I describe in my books, I preach a constructive skepticism. For me, I'm not tearing anything down. I'm not popping the balloon and raining on people's parade. What I'm doing is I'm saying, hey, I see you got your little party going over there, but hey, look over here. Look at the natural world. Look at the universe. Look at this. And think of all the free time, the energy, the money, the health risk. Think of all the things you can save if you just think a little more clearly about what you're doing with your life. So I'm trying to add, not take away. I mean, I'm not cynical. I'm not negative. I'm completely positive. And for me, skepticism is a moral issue. I care about the world. I care about people. I think I'm optimistic. I think we can do much better than we're doing now. I think that we really can build a better world. Far from perfect. I mean, I don't have any fantasies about that. We'll always have problems. But we can do so much better if we were only more skeptical and thought more rationally. We could do so much better. So that's why I go around talking about this stuff, because I just think the more people who figure this out and try to align themselves with reality and are not willing to be foolishly led astray in their lives, I think we'll have a better world.
I want to go back a little bit, and I want to talk. I want to just find out a little bit more about you, and why is it that you are not doing anything that's necessarily related to your degrees? Just as a kind of curiosity, because it seems as though, from at least what I read in the short descriptions that you have of yourself, that you went to school and then you just traveled and have been writing, and then have a number of other hobbies that you've turned into work, photography, design.
I was a journalist. I mean, I still am sort of a journalist. I still write some stuff and get paid for it and all, but I was a full-time journalist for probably 15 years. I mean, I did everything in the newspaper world. I was editorial writer, features writer, sports editor, photographer, page designer. You know, I've done it all. I mean, that's kind of how I was paying the bills. And I've traveled around. It was great because, I was able to cover the Olympics. I've traveled everywhere, written stories about all. I've been to every continent except Antarctica, and written about many, many places. And the great thing about being a journalist is you have an excuse to just approach strange and interesting people and start asking them very personal questions, And I've taken full advantage of that, and we've done that all over the world. That's how my first book, 50 Reasons People Give for Believing in a God, that's how that book came to be. Traveling the world, inevitably, when I'm talking to people, I would sooner or later bring up religion, because it is one of the most important aspects of humanity. It's just so universal and so influential, so you always get around to it. And whether I was talking to Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, whoever, it was an amazing thing. The same little grab bag of justifications for belief would always be used. They would always be played. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. So that's what that first book is. It's a skeptical response to these common justifications that virtually all believers use around the world.
I was actually surprised that your first one wasn't on pseudoscience and skepticism in general, because that's the one that you've recently written, right? I think that was December of 2011 that came out.
Yeah, that's 50 popular beliefs that people think are true. There are some chapters in there about religious claims, but that one's sort of just a grand tour of all extraordinary claims and irrational beliefs, all the popular ones, UFOs, psychics, ghosts, Bermuda Triangle, all the fun stuff's in there, alternative medicine. Got it all in there. And in that book, one thing really important in that book that I'm really glad I was able to pull off is I'm not just a debunker. I'm not just saying, oh, homeopathic medicine is stupid and here's why. Next chapter. I don't do it that way. Every chapter, I try to give something back. I try to be positive. I try to turn people's interest or enthusiasm into these subjects and turn it and redirect it into something real and positive that has a better chance for a payoff for them. Like, for example, Bigfoot. I have a chapter on Bigfoot and cryptozoology. And I talk about how, I give all the reasons it's extremely unlikely that a gigantic 9-foot primate is running around in the forests of Oregon. That's just not likely. They would need a breeding population of about 1,000. It's just,
what would they eat?
Yeah, well, I don't know, little campers or something. I don't know, because I mean, it's
so.
Just it's extremely unlikely that no hunter would have shot one, or nobody ran one over by now, and we don't have a body. It's just very unlikely. But rather than just leave it at that, I talk about, I say, hey, if you're interested in discovering new species of life, if you're fascinated by monsters, well, guess what? There's a thing called science that is finding monsters all the time, and they're searching for them. Check out astrobiology. The actual legitimate science that's studying the possibilities of life on other planets. I mean, that's interesting. An astrobiologist will tell you, just to be clear for your listeners, we don't know that there's life beyond the Earth, but there's definitely reason to look and reason to think about it. And they study these little microbes on Earth called extremophiles that live in the most amazing places, caves a mile deep, no sunlight, boiling water under the bottom of the ocean, in the muck of the deep seas. There's so much life. And a marine biologist today can barely dip their net into the ocean without finding some new microorganisms that nobody's ever seen before. It's just incredible. And if you look at these things, they are monsters, many of them. Right now, your listeners hearing this, trust me, they have things on their face and crawling around in their bed and crawling around on the floor eating their dead skin cells right
those
now.
Those are the real monsters.
Yeah, exactly. It would freak them out. They're awesome creatures. This is, it's, you know, no fantasy can match this stuff. So it's exciting. It's science. Science is fascinating. It's thrilling. You don't need to rely on pseudoscience and fantasy and extraordinary unproven claims to get your kicks. You don't need to.
Here's the greatest tragedy in all of this, too, is like you were mentioning, all the things that are on your face are lying in your bed. And as much as you think you can know, it's always changing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, our bodies.
There's always going to be more.
Yeah. The human body is an ecosystem with legs. We are walking rainforests. I mean, it's incredible. You're outnumbered. I mean, something like 10 to 1, 100 to 1, I can't remember. You're out in the trillions of microbes live on you, in you. And most of them don't hurt you at all. Many of them help you. You need them to do things like digest your food. And then some of them can be dangerous, you know. So it's an exciting field. And that's just microbes. That's just one thing out there. Scientists are still finding big creatures. We find big things. I predict within the next 20 or 30 years, there's going to be some really, really great discoveries in the deep, deep oceans, because the robot technology is getting so, so good that we're going to just be exploring so much more down there. We're bound to find some new, exciting things. I mean, big things. You know, mark my words. There's a lot to not lot coming, I bet.
Now, let me ask you this question. You travel a lot as a journalist, and I guess in your travels, does this explain your second book, the one that's on race and sort of like how we view that?
Race and Reality. Right. Yeah, that book is probably was born two things. The anthropology, studying anthropology really opened my eyes with a lot of stuff. And another thing is I grew up in the South in a country that is obsessed with race. So race was a huge issue. It was very, very just kind of always intrigued me. And I thought, you know, wow, this is a weird thing. And I used to believe it. And then all of a sudden I go away to college like little boys do and have my eyes opened by science. And, you know, I've got these anthropology professors telling me, oh, by the way, race is a bunch of garbage. You know, it's a made up fantasy. It's a cultural creation. And I thought, what are you talking about? And I thought, clearly this is some, you know, this is a political correctness run amok. They're just trying to get us to all live in peace and telling us some lie or something, because obviously you can tell people are different. There are races, right? But I looked into this. And as years went by, I researched it so much and talked to so many people that I was just shocked that that something that is so widely believed, and that's I'm talking about the common perception of racial, biological race categories, you know, like some black people, white people, that kind of thing. It's so common, and yet it's so wrong. And I thought, my gosh. And there have been books written about it. Anthropologists have been saying this for 50 years now that it makes no sense. In 1998, the American Anthropological Association released a brief statement on race, and it was their official statement from their association. And they said, racial categories as perceived by the general public are completely wrong. These are culturally constructed groups, and they cause a lot of harm. And that sort of frustrated me, because nobody got the memo. You know, nobody reads the American Anthropological Association statements. And so I wrote this book in a way that's very readable for just the, you know, typical layperson, and yet it presents the science and the common sense and explains why believing in biological categories of race make no sense and do harm to the world. Right now, I'm sure many listeners are going, oh, that's nuts. You know, I can stand a black person next to a white person, next to an Asian person, and see three kinds of humans. So clearly races are real and natural. And my response is, no, they're not, you know, because the human species is not a three-man lineup, okay? There are billions of people that fit in between your black guy, your white guy, and your Asian guy. And if you put all of them there, you see instantly that there are no natural divisions, no natural borders between people. I mean, race is an imaginary thing. We have diversity is real, okay? But racial categories are not.
It goes to show how good we are at being able to create distinctions based on something as arbitrary as pigmentation. I mean, for us, it's still a big deal, right? But you realize it is a fucking pigmentation, like, shade. is what it is.
When you research this topic and you actually, the light goes on, you realize, oh my gosh, race is just another bad religion. It relies on science, illiteracy, and indoctrination. Without it, it goes away. You know, I mean, it's just incredible. A couple of quick examples. I knew a girl in college, a light-skinned girl from Haiti, okay? And when she was in Florida, she was black, okay? When she went home during Christmas, she became white again back home because the one-drop rule is reversed in Haiti. It's different. In America, they can be very light-skinned, but if they have at least a little bit of visually detectable recent African ancestry, they're probably going to be labeled as black. Well, in Haiti, it's reversed because she had at least some, you know, she in her homeland, she becomes white, whereas in America, she's black. Same thing, I knew people, I lived in the Cayman Islands for several years. I knew many people there who were not black by their own description and that of their society. But when they got on a plane and flew to Miami to go Christmas shopping or something, when they step off the plane, they become black people. Different rules. It's a cultural game. Same thing with time. If we had a time machine, you could take a white Irish man, put him in a time machine, send him back to America in the 1840s, and he wouldn't be white anymore. You know, because back there was a time when white Irish people were not quite white people. They were a little bit below. Sorry, fellas, you don't quite make the cut.
You were those filthy gingers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just incredible. And the more you see about this, how the rules of race change across societies, they constantly change over time. You just see instantly that this is just a made-up game. Look at it. You know, right now, America has its first black president, Barack Obama, and he's in a different race from his own mother. The woman who gave birth to him is in a different race from her son. And race is supposed to be about kinship and biology, yet he came out of a woman and is in a different race from her. That's an indication right there of the problems with this concept. And the thing is, it wouldn't matter so much, except that we imagine all of these limitations and abilities, and we tag them with these groupings, and then we actually direct and influence people's lives. We restrict people's potential based on these beliefs, and that's the tragedy. That's why I really wrote this book, because it's sad to see little children around the world thinking they can't do this, they should do this, when really they should be free to do anything they want, or at least dream about doing anything they want.
So you're saying that in certain places, these racial stereotypes are what make people sort of doubt their capabilities in other areas? Or
absolutely.
Is that how that plays out?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I cite many studies in the book that show, you know, people given tests, if you just talk about racial stereotypes before they start the test, they will score lower than if you had not brought them up and made them fresh in their minds. I mean, these things, it's terrible. It really is. What a big influence this is from everything. I have chapters on race and health, because race-based medicine is a big thing that's coming, and it's completely wrong and dangerous. I have a chapter on race and sports, and talk about how that continually reinforces misconceptions about human diversity. It's a fascinating book. I loved interviewing scientists and researching it. It's great. And just to be clear, it's not about liberal conservative. It's not a way to try to get everybody to live in peace or anything like that. You know, example I give is I'm very much against sexism. I think gender fairness is a very good thing. I don't think women should be dominated or mistreated, but I would never pretend that there are not two genders of the human species, okay, just as a way to try to get past that. So the same thing with race. I would never pretend that racial categories didn't exist just because I wanted everybody to get along better if they really did exist. But the fact is, they don't.
Well, you have to look at it from that biological perspective. You know, when just a few changes result in such drastic outcomes, you know, like for instance with dogs, like one gene controls their size. And you realize that for us, the size of something seems like a big deal, right? And you don't realize how easy it is to change and how much it could just mutate in a very short period of time. And you know what? It's probably a good thing, coming from the fact that we developed from like rat-like species. It's probably a good thing.
Yeah. And you know, the whole field of epigenetics has taken off, where you know, you just don't know what genes you have, and you don't know, if the buttons of those genes were ever pushed and they were activated.
Or if they can be activated even in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. Like you don't know, Jake, if your childhood had been slightly different one way or the other, you might have been 7 feet tall. You don't know. It's an amazing thing. You can't say much about human potential. I mean, you really can't, because we just don't know. All you can do is measure results. I mean, it's very difficult. That's why I have a chapter on race and intelligence, and I talk about the problems there and how it is absolutely ludicrous for people to think they can generalize about the intelligence of large groups of people associated with race labels. I mean, it's just absolutely tragic, because sure, there's diversity and intellectual potential, but nobody's ever been able to identify it within the context of huge groups of tens of millions of people. I mean, it's absurd.
Well, I'm sure you probably read Stephen Jay Gould's book, The Mismeasure of Man, before you wrote your book,
sure,
I'm assuming.
Sure, sure.
And I think that what he was saying in that one, in that particular book, was also the fact that as soon as the standards of intelligence, like, you know, standardized tests supposedly measuring intelligence, where other minorities were doing good, tests were changed in order to try to compensate for that.
Yeah,
and you realize
sure.
that there is there the element that people are like the human interference in any test like that anyways.
Yeah.
Is probably the biggest reason why we don't actually have any good science. I think there's still a lot of latent racism even within the scientific community. And it's not generally in the scientific community, but just sort of like there can be scientists who still believe that there are things like races, you know, like I've seen this all
sure,
the time.
Of course. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. But it's just, it's sad, because if you split the human species in your head, if you split it up into these teams, it's just human nature to rank them. I mean, you just can't help but do it. You have to. We're primates, you know. We're like chimps sitting on the hill wondering who's the top dog. You know, we can't help but rank each other. So I think it's inevitable. So if we're going to come up with a team, with some sort of collection of teams, the teams ought to at least make sense. And as it is now, they don't. You know, for example, like race and sports, for example, people are forever saying, you know, oh, black people are great runners. Well, what do you mean by black people? Because West Africans and Caribbean blacks tend to do very well in sprints, and East Africans tend to do very well in distance events these days. But guess what? They're not. When you call them black people, it's completely ignorant as far as the reality of human diversity and biology, because I, as a so-called white person, am more closely related to a typical Ethiopian than a West African is to a typical Ethiopian. Okay.
Well, because they don't have any Neanderthal DNA in them. That was one of the big sort of like differences between living African populations and the rest of Homo sapiens that live in other continents, that we have a portion of Neanderthal DNA.
Yeah, you know, I just read something fascinating. Side note, there's new information about a supervolcano that went off that might have helped push the Neanderthals off the brink. And otherwise, they might have still been around today. That's interesting. Anyway, sorry.
Trust me, this is the Tangity podcast. If you apologize for mentioning something that was Tangity, I'm going to go down to, well, where are you living right now? Because I'm going to have to figure out where you live to bitch slap you, because there's no need for that. This is the Tangity podcast. This is where we're introducing people to interesting concepts. I mean, like, look, we're already down to two interesting concepts, which now leads me to, I guess, my third part, which is sort of like, I guess, now that you've sort of like, your first book is you try to tackle a friendly way to get people to change their assumptions about their belief about God. And I've read many of the reviews, by the way, which are mostly glowing. And I mean, like a significant portion of them are really, really well praised.
Which book are we talking about?
Your first book.
50 Reasons People Give for Believing in a God.
For believing in a God, which is also kind of an important distinction, because you don't just tackle the three monotheistic fucking bullies.
Exactly. I always say, you know, your skepticism should be consistent and fair across the board. If you're gonna take on Jesus, well, you need to take on all the other gods too. Don't just, you know, go for one, go for all of them. And I think that actually makes your case much stronger when you do that.
Well, it definitely shows that you're on, you're putting everyone up to the same standard. And I guess that whenever, if you don't, you can often be playing into religious people's hands. I'm sure you've heard this kind of justification for Christianity where they say, well, it's living history. That's why it's true. This is a very common justification. I don't know if it's in your 50 reasons, but I can definitely tell you that most Christians that I read their comments on Christian sites like you would not believe. And one of the popular things that I read is like, well, Jesus is in history, so it has to be true.
Well, in history, what do you mean? I mean, my first question, okay, start showing me what are you talking about? Just because people run around doing things in the name of a god or because they're influenced by the concept of a god doesn't prove the god exists.
No, but I mean, for them, they're like, they take for granted this idea that Jesus is a historical person. And because of that, and you know what, like...
You mean as opposed to Vishnu or some god that is not so... rooted in relatively recent times? Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Like if I'm debunking Thor or Mithras, see, there is a kind of a... I would say that there's probably a golden period all religion.
All right, well, hold on, Jake. Here's your response to that, okay?
Okay.
Well, right. I can top that because there's a guy in Miami right now who says he's a god, and he has a church full of people who, you know, clap and give him money every Sunday. There really is a guy who says he's the Messiah. And
is he the Mexican guy?
No.
Because that guy has a really huge following. Jesus, like this guy claims to be the resurrection of Jesus, and he has like a massive following.
I don't know. I'm not sure. But yeah, he says he's a living God. He's...
Oh, you know, he might be Cuban. You might be right. It's difficult to say. Anyways, I just know that he's Hispanic, so it's my racist self for not knowing. Hell, he could be from Ecuador, and I don't know, but I'm bad at geography, so nobody fucking hold me up to that.
Yeah, but he is a god now. That's better than 2,000 years ago, right? He's talk about living history. He's living now. I mean, and disprove, how can you disprove he's not a god? Disprove it.
Well, this actually brings me to what I was about to say, which is to say where I think that there's a kind of golden period for religion to exist where it's important for you to have enough history where the person that you think is a god is now long dead. So they don't need to sort of prove anything. But for some weird reason, there's been enough belief for long enough that everyone's like, oh, yeah, well, I should just believe. They've been believing for like a few hundred years. Although there is a catch. I think that once it becomes too long, then sort of like, I guess people just sort of give up hope on it. They're like, well, I don't think Mithras is coming back.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah. There's like a tipping point when it's here to stay, but then it fades. I think rather than just people sort of giving up, I think the example of history is more that it's been a result of either economic domination, colonization, or victory in war. That's what has made some religions just go away and then other ones stick for a while. That's what it is. Like if Islam had just swept through Europe and really took over a few centuries ago, well, hey, you know, Christianity might be completely dead today. It could easily have happened.
Well, let me ask you a question. If Alexander the Great wouldn't have defeated Darius III, would Zoroastrianism be like the big religion of the day?
Could be, absolutely. I mean, it's all a cultural game. It's the whims of history, man. It could go either way. It's like, why is basketball so popular in America and not curling? Make all the jokes you want about curling, but hey, it's still a sport. It obviously excites some people. The potential is there. It could easily be a massive sport in America with its own Super Bowl and, you know, million-dollar athletes playing. It could be, you know, but it didn't. Didn't work out that way. Look at lacrosse. Why is lacrosse not more popular than soccer? There's no real reason other than the way it worked out in history.
Yeah, well, like you said before, these cultural forces that kind of tend to dominate and bring in all of these ideas, most of them, many of them bad. I mean, like, let's look at an example, like you were mentioning before, child witches in Nigeria, for instance, which is something that I have podcasted about in the past for a long time, because this is a personal issue of mine. Like, it breaks my heart knowing that just a fraction of the religious rights influence in Africa is a direct result of this tragedy, you know, like where the dangerous mix of ancient superstitions and their own superstitions come together in the worst possible way. And all of a sudden you're just, you know, like a person who's constantly telling you, well, religion is a source of good. You can be like, I don't care how many times it is a source of good. None of that justifies what it does in a practical way, in the world itself. Like when the Pope says, don't wear a condom because it's worse and you're more likely to get AIDS, or whatever other fucking lie he's saying at the time. I mean, you got to say, like, at what point do we just tell a person, you are a homicidal maniac saying that kind of shit?
Yeah.
You know, you should be put in jail for that kind of irresponsible fucking behavior.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. Sloppy thinking I point this out in my last book, 50 Popular Beliefs. I point out that it may seem completely harmless to believe in UFOs or to believe in psychics. It might seem on the surface to be harmless. You might waste a few bucks, a little time, but so what? You know, maybe it's fun. What's the harm? But sloppy thinking is a dangerous habit to get into, because people who can become convinced that the Bermuda Triangle is real and Atlantis is really down there and there's aliens living in some underwater city, people who can be convinced of that can also be convinced that magic is dangerous and we need to ban Harry Potter books. And you know what? Maybe we need to go beat up that witch down the street, you know, and maybe even go kill her. So that's a very dangerous path. And I point that out over and over, because a lot of people, I hear that a lot about this defense against many of the things I go after, saying, well, what's the harm? You know, astrology doesn't hurt anybody. Well, yes, it does, because it's sloppy thinking. And if you see it in the United States and Canada, you see Christian preachers talking about magic and their witches are bad. Now, they don't organize witch hunts and go kill people, but they will say, like, you know, don't let your children read Harry Potter books, for example, because it's a gateway to the occult or something like that. Well, you know what? That may be harmless in a sense, but it's not that far removed from saying, hey, that kid down the street is a child witch. Let's go get him. You know, that's not that far away.
Well, I wish they would understand their involvement in creating the culture of fear. And ultimately what that means, I mean, I was watching a documentary on the assassination of George Tiller, and they were just talking about, like, all of these pro-life groups that essentially say some of the most violent rhetoric you could possibly believe, and then all of a sudden when someone does something, which they never condemn anyways, they're saying, well, we weren't responsible, we didn't pull the trigger, not realizing that a person's actions was like the culture that generated these actions has to be held accountable. Like, you can't just create a culture of fear and then walk away from it and say, it wasn't me, I didn't do nothing.
Yeah, if I was with, say, you know, I'm interviewing with somebody and they start saying, you know what, guy, you know, it'd be a great idea if we start just rounding up all these religious people and putting them in camps and maybe killing a few of them to set an example. That might straighten out the world. And finally, you know, we'd become a rational species. I would jump all over them. I would say, no, whoa, back up. You know, no, I believe in the freedom of thought. People should be free to think and believe whatever they want to believe. And I don't think anybody should be arrested or abused in any way just for their thoughts. Now, if they're harming somebody, that's another matter. But, you know, that is wrong. And I would be all over it. You know, I would never want to be a part of a culture that promoted that sort of dangerous condemnation of other people, other groups, because it can lead to really bad things. I would never be a part of it. And that's why I'm disappointed more Christians and more Muslims don't come out and loudly, loudly condemn this rampant, you know, anti-witchcraft, anti-homosexual, all this stuff that goes on in their religions that is so harmful to other people, because they're, by believing in their religion and supporting it, they're sort of propping up these loonies that are really dangerous and want to take it to the extreme and actually hurt people. So they should be reining these people in more than anyone, but they don't do it.
Well, I kind of have to wonder if sometimes they don't secretly wish that it was just so. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but a little while ago, the Pentagon was embarrassed when a bunch of army documents were leaked where they were just training people saying, well, we might have to bomb Mecca. Just gotta, right. If they don't calm down.
I remember that. Yeah.
And then realize that's, you know, everybody, the people who drafted that would not describe themselves as fundamentalist, but they don't realize that's a culture of fear, just like pseudoscience or all those things are cultures of ignorance. And then anybody who believes in it, their harm is in supporting that culture of fucking ignorance. Or you're just like you said before, sloppy thinking. But for me, it's more, it's not just sloppy thinking. It's that as soon as a person tells me that their belief that they were kidnapped by a UFO is as scientific as my belief that they didn't, there's something wrong. You know, I don't know if you remember reading the first chapter of Candle in the Dark by Carl Sagan.
I love that book. Yeah.
And he just mentions that taxi driver.
Right, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, where he just talks about, he's like, this guy was really educated about all kinds of nonsense.
I've met many people like that. Yeah, many people. Especially conspiracy theory people. They are extremely educated and intelligent on their thing, you know?
It's amazing. It's difficult to, you know, to argue because what... You know, when you find yourself debating against a conspiracy theorist, this is not, like you said before, with a religious person, this is not an idiot, but they have just come to believe things for really illogical reasons, and it's difficult to get them to see that. I remember I was living with a conspiracy theorist, and I remember just one conversation was just exploding into, you know, like into screaming and that kind of stuff, and it was just... It had gotten emotional when all I was really trying to do was kind of get him to prove his assertions. And when he felt embarrassed by not being able to do that, when he had finally reached the limit of another site he couldn't find to cite me some ridiculous fact, he got very fucking defensive and very angry. And he was also a giant man, so I don't know if that was exactly the best idea on my part.
Yeah, it's confirmation bias run amok. That's what it is.
Well, I mean, and it plays into a lot of people's fears and anxieties. I only imagine it must be kind of growing as a phenomenon, especially with the mistrust of government and corporations. I can't imagine that it's gotten better. Has it?
Has what gotten better? What specifically?
The fight against conspiracy theorists or that type of irrationality, you know, that's stirred up by the mistrust of government.
I don't think so. I mean, the thing with conspiracy theories, I mean, it's interesting, and I have a chapter on that in my most recent book. There are conspiracies. There are. People do get together and do bad things all the time, you know. I mean, 9/11 was a conspiracy. But it was all the evidence points to Al-Qaeda being the conspirators. So, yeah, I mean, conspiracy theories are not quite the same as, say, belief in ghosts, which require some sort of bending of the laws of physics or violating the laws of physics. With conspiracy theories, I think they'll always be with us because in the end, they're rooted in two things, gossip and good stories. And we as humans, our brains are just like horny for gossip and good stories every second of our lives. We can't resist them. So, you know, I will listen to a good conspiracy theory before I walk away. I can't resist listening, at least hearing. Maybe it's true. You know? I want to hear some dirt. Yeah. But, you know, scientists actually, they think that gossip and storytelling are sort of the social glue that allowed us to unite so well and work so well in groups in our early, early prehistory. So, you know, I don't think you're ever going to defeat suspicions that somebody out there is plotting to do bad things behind our backs. And that would help explain all these things going on in our world that are so bad. That's the reason, you know, because we're also always looking for reasons for everything. And sometimes there's just not really good or satisfying reasons.
What do you think has been the response for your first book, the one about God, was really good, and it seems as though this new book, the 50 popular belief that people think are true, is actually seems to be getting even more attention. I think it beat Freakonomics there in sort of popular culture books there for a little while, isn't it?
Yeah, yesterday it was number one in Amazon's pop culture category, which is a very competitive category. So it's doing really well. I mean, the reviews are great. The you know, endorsements are strong. The reader reviews are good. I'm getting tons of positive feedback from people. I'm getting some pushback. Interestingly, it's the alternative medicine people that have been coming after me the most. You know, not religious people, not the psychics, but the anti-vaccine people and the homeopathic people. They're really passionate, and they think it's funny. One of them, on and on and on, this email saying that I'm obviously and clearly on the payroll of big pharmaceutical companies, and I've been paid off, you know, to put out this propaganda for science against alternative medicine. And I thought that was, I'm like, wow, okay, that would be great. I wish I was getting a check in the mail, but it's not quite true, you know. I have not been bought off.
I'd be driving a very different car if I was under those circumstances. Well, you know who has it bad, though? I mean, if you think you got it bad, imagine you were Ben Goldacre. Because they don't have like the same kind of protection, free speech protection that you enjoy. I mean, over there, he's been fighting these vitamin guys, these fucking homeopathic guys.
Chiropractics.
Like, he's fighting the good fight, fuck.
Yeah. With alternative medicine, you know, I don't even understand why they have a problem, because if they actually read what I wrote, I concede that probably there are many things that fall under the tent of alternative medicine that do work, that do help people. But until the scientific process is used, you can't determine which things work and which things don't. You can't just go on stories because, you know, Aunt Sarah took it and felt better the next day, therefore it'll work on me. I mean, that's all nonsense, and you're risking your health. And I just point out that evidence-based medicine, science, scientific process has a proven track record. That's why we live to be 70 and 80 years old today. That's why we should give a little respect to this thing called science over here, which is saving people every day. And when we just turn it over and say, oh, it's natural, drink this and everything will be great. And all. And then they also act like, for some reason, they think mainstream medicine has exclusive rights to greed and unethical behavior, you know, which do exist in that world, no doubt. But I'm astonished by how many people think that alternative medicine is just completely run and marketed and sold by the most...
By hippies.
But yeah, people who just love everyone and don't want to make any profit, and they would never bend the truth. I mean, give me a break, you know? That there's so much fraud and deceit and profit in that. I mean, oh my gosh, that, talk about conspiracy theories. Jeez.
It gets pretty scary when you consider the fact that, you know, guys like, let's say Andy Kaufman is a perfect example. Like, he went to a psychic surgeon hoping that that would help. You know what? I think he might have been able to live longer if he didn't do that. I mean, same with Steve Jobs. Oh, you got cancer. Try this alternative diet. How about you don't, you stupid idiot? Like, don't put faith in that kind of bullshit. And you know what? The big tragedy, too, is that none of these guys that made that claim in the first place that these guys bought into were ever had to be held accountable for the death toll they have. Like, even the anti-vaxxers that sort of like passionately come and try to debate you, they have a death toll on their hands and they don't even know it.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, it really is. It's tragic. It's just, it's unacceptable. In fact, those chapters where I deal with alternative medicine is where my tone turns a little dark, a little grumpy. Okay, I'm not so cheery and upbeat as I am with Bigfoot.
Not so friendly.
And the triangle. Yeah, because I give example after example of people dying because they put their faith in alternative medicine and didn't go to the doctor. People, children dying, little babies dying in agony because one example in Australia, the father was a homeopathic doctor, and he insisted on treating his little baby child's eczema with homeopathic treatments, wouldn't take her to a real doctor. And the baby, over a period of months, died in complete agony. I mean, it's just tragic. And I cite one study by Harvard where they found over, I believe it was a 4 or 5 year period in South Africa, the government there had turned to promoting alternative medicine as a way to treat HIV as opposed to evidence-based medicine. And during that period, they found that I believe it was about 300,000 people died prematurely because of that decision by the government. I mean, that's a big death toll, you know. That's crazy. And that this stuff, it goes on all the time. I've known so many people who put their faith in something because the pill looks attractive, or they heard a good story, so they'll take it. No, they don't, who knows what's in it, you know? And another thing I point out, in fairness, this is not all about people who just lack skepticism. Many people are in situations where they just don't have the money or the opportunity to take advantage of real medicine, evidence-based medicine. They have to rely on traditional medicine or alternative medicine because it's cheaper and it's available. And that's sad. That's like a moral issue for the world to confront. You know, that's tragic, because I cite one case in Pakistan where women found to have lumps in their breasts, a high percentage were relying on traditional methods and not getting treated in ways they should. And the death rate, which of course was much higher for those women. Same in Africa. I found another study where men were having severe kidney problems because they were taking all these traditional remedies as opposed to tested medicines, properly tested medicines. And the death toll is just staggering. It's horrible, you know. So it's a very serious issue. It really is.
The way that alternative medicine has advertised itself, because it can say whatever it wants, you know, if like a homeopathic claim that the most diluted substance in the fucking universe can give you any effect at all because somehow it retains memory.
Yeah.
I mean, I sincerely hope it doesn't retain the memory of that pliosaur that pissed it out.
Yeah, right. Or me last week when I flushed my toilet. Yeah. But, I mean, come on. There's no science behind it. Any credible science will tell you it's completely, completely unproven. And any results anybody gets can be, you know, is if anything really does happen, it's probably the placebo effect. It's just it's just shocking that it's so popular. And it sadly, it had almost died out in the U.S., you know. It was almost gone completely. It was strong in Europe. But in the last probably 10, 20 years, it seems to be surging back in the U.S. And you see it in grocery stores and CVS. I approached a pharmacist in CVS, a CVS pharmacy here in the U.S. and asked her, how do you feel when you're behind that counter dispensing science-based medicine to people who need it every day, and then 15 feet away from you is this magic water that seems more appropriate to the Middle Ages? You know, how does that make you feel? And she, you know, hummed and hemmed and hummered, and she kind of said, well, it's not my department. I don't really have anything to do with it. I know it's nonsense, but it's not really, I can't do anything. I'm just behind the counter. And I thought, wow, man, that's, you know, all the pharmacists in all these drugstore chains should protest. You know, they should sit out from work one day or something, I don't know, to get all this junk out of their immediate workspace, because it's such a contradiction. You have, you know, and I looked at the labels. There are things that are supposed to be able to cure migraines, malaria, I mean, everything you could imagine. There's even, I found one, diabetes. It's right there.
So why
would you bother going to the pharmacy counter and get your prescribed diabetes medication when you can just buy this little vial of water here for about $10, you know? I mean, why? You know, same store selling it.
I can't even imagine that a person selling homeopathic diabetes medicine is not in jail.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That is criminal. I mean,
yeah.
That is just monstrous. And I guess, again, like, we go back to this whole idea that everybody always just tells, you know, like, the defense is just like, oh, well, it's not harming anybody.
The specific reason for that is lobbyists. The supplement industry, the vitamin industry, they've, you know, worked the system very well. Nothing unethical, probably. They donated to the right politicians. They've done all the right things. As far as I can tell, all above board. And the laws have all been finessed to suit them just perfectly. I mean, it's just tragic. You know, Orrin Hatch, for example, senator in Utah, is one of those prominent people that really made it easy for the supplement industry to just go crazy and make all kind of claims and throw all kind of stuff and no regulation, just whatever. You know, in fact, it even got to me. I was shocked a couple of years ago. Like, I go to the gym, lift weights and stuff, and for a while I was chugging protein shakes all the time just as a convenience after the workout. And then Consumer Reports they tested a bunch of the most popular brands of protein shakes, and they found heavy metals, all kind of toxins in. I was shocked. I was like, oh my God, because there's no regulation. So you just got to be careful, man. Just stick to fruit and vegetables, man.
So let me ask you this question. Now that you've written about God, about pseudoscience, and even about race, I mean, is there a fourth one that's been kind of like, you know, sort of like in your mind? What?
I'm writing two as we speak. I mean, one's about a third of the way finished. The next one that will be out, probably be about a year or so, actually. It's Simple Questions Every Christian Should Answer. So all my previous books have been sort of generalized, generic, just religious claims in general. You know, how do you know your God is true? How do you know? How do you know that prayer really works? And I would address it that way. Could apply to any religion. But with this book, I'm going to specifically address all the claims in Christianity, all the basic claims in Christianity. Just the does Jesus answer prayers? Yes or no? Here it goes. And I'm trying to write the book in a way that hopefully Christians will be challenged to read it. And it won't be just some angry atheist screaming at them. It's going to be a guy who is unconvinced of their claims, who's saying, hey, here's why I'm not convinced. What do you think about this? You know, read this and do some thinking. So I'm hopeful. It's a way to try to reach out to them and get them to really think deeper about all these things they keep saying about, you know, miracles and heaven and hell and Jesus and all this stuff. So we'll see. And then the other one I'm writing is going to be sort of an introductory book for skeptical thinking. It's going to be a really easy to read, attractive, upbeat, super positive book for somebody who's never even heard the word skeptic and doesn't even know what you're talking about. Like, why in the world should I question magic? Of course magic's real. What are you talking about? Well, this will be the book you hand them. This will be the one. So those are the two. It's probably going to be called The New Thinker.
And okay, so here's my final question before we sort of like leave off. And this will be hopefully a question that brings up a lot of discussion, because, I mean, you talked about being a positive guy, and it seems as though you have a kind of vision for the future. Does any of this have anything to do with your love for Star Trek?
You know, a good question. Wow. Wow, that's weird. You know, nobody's ever really asked me that. I wonder, because I did grow up watching reruns of the original series, Kirk and Spock, you know, and that Gene Roddenberry's vision is such a positive one. It's not far-fetched to think it did have an influence on me, to think that, wow, we really can, you know, wake up from this nightmare and stop stumbling around in the dark like morons and, you know, howling at the moon and all this stuff. We really can travel to the stars and get along and not. Yeah, that's fascinating. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, who knows?
I have a few examples that I think is sort of like proof of that. Example number one is your second book. And I would cite the episode. I forget which episode, where one species had black on one side and white on the other.
Oh, right.
And then
right,
they sort of like fight to death. Can't you see? He is white on the left side.
Yeah, exactly.
And then later you write Could a book be. About racism. Coincidence? That's,
oh, man, I think you've nailed me, man. It's all there in my childhood. You're right.
And plus, you're the diplomat, too. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is maybe where perhaps you weren't so much of a Kirk, because then you would have been punching people around here.
Yeah, that's true. I've got a little Kirk and a little Spock in me both, you know, And I was in love with her. I was in love with Uhura. So, you know, yeah, it all makes sense now. It all comes.
But, you know, I got to tell you something about Uhura that perhaps you're not aware of. She was really mistreated on the show. I don't know if you remember this, but go back and watch. She is perpetually berated. She's told that she's doing a bad job. She kind of gets shit on all the time. And what is her job? Glorified secretary. I'm just going to put it out there. Right. Sure, it was a big step, but let's remember.
But at the time, it was huge. You know, I met her actually. I had a chance to meet her and talk with her. But at the time, it was huge. Martin Luther King Jr. actually contacted her. She was going to quit the show, and she said that he contacted her and said, you know, hey, I just want to let you know that you're such a great role model on TV, and Black Americans need to see this, and it's good for White America to see this. You're just so dignified and blah blah blah. And then she goes, oh well, thank you, but you know, I'm thinking of quitting. I just want to go on to other things. He was like, no, you can't. This is like the most amazing thing on TV. You can't do it. So she stuck it out and stayed, you know, the final season.
Well, and you know what the connection with that with Next Generation is?
What's that?
Well, it turns out that Whoopi Goldberg watched Star Trek The Next Generation. When she saw Uhura, she's like, look, Ma, there's a black woman on TV and she ain't no maid. And then after that, she wanted to be an actress, which is why she was in Star Trek The Next Generation. She insisted on it because she's like, this is the reason why I'm an actress.
That's funny. Well, Jake, I think you've nailed it, man. You've completely deciphered my complex childhood and explained my motivation. So I just need to review all the original series episodes to find out what my next books are going to be. Oh my gosh.
I think so.
You know what? I'm actually thinking about a book about the singularity, the heaven and hell scenario, the possible like super technologically advanced future that we might have. And that's interesting. That remember there's a one, I think it's called Taste of Armageddon. I think where war has been reduced to just a computer game and people have to terminate themselves. I think that was the name of it. And wow, you got me thinking now. God, my whole life is just a review of the Star Trek series.
Well, wow. you kind of spelled it out on even your own page where you said you mentioned Star Trek and how you use it to teach lessons. And I'm like, maybe that has a bigger impact than you think. But I'll tell you why. I have a little pet theory, and you can tell me if it's somewhere on the mark. Because I've been talking about this a lot with people, is that I think that the advantage that religion has, because a part of it, maybe a third of it, is prophecy. And for them, prophecy is a way to give people a vision of the future. Now, I don't believe in religious prophecy because I think it gives the most nightmarish scenario of any possible future, just one of destruction and despair. But for us, like, I call this myth-making, that there is still an ability for us to kind of myth-make forward to say, well, where would we like to be? And this is what I think Star Trek is still significant for people, because it is myth-making of the future.
Yeah. Gene Roddenberry is the prophet. Blessed be his name. You're right. you're right.
The atheist prophet.
Yeah. That's funny.
Okay, well, you know what? I think that we'll leave it at that, because everybody's probably either really happy or really mad at us. So we'll leave on those two things. And with that, I'd like to thank my guest, Guy Harrison, for being on the show. And we look forward to your other books. On the site itself will be the links to all of those books. I recommend you check them out. And just stay tuned with what he's doing. He's got there's going to be a link for his Twitter. What's your Twitter address, if you can just give it out?
Harrison Author.
Harrison Author. So you can stay updated with all the stuff that he's working on. So check out his stuff. Thanks, Guy, for coming on the show.
All right, Jake, thanks so much for having me, man. I wish you all the best with your podcast. You're doing a great job.
Thanks a lot. Have a good Atheist Day, everybody. So there's a couple things I definitely want to talk about that. And then I guess I can say that you're the author of several books, as well as...
Three.
Yeah. Well, that's several, isn't it?
Well, no, that sounds like, don't exaggerate.
But it is. That's what several is.
Oh, okay.
Several is like more than two.
Oh, okay.
You can say several. Don't be shy. Look, I read on your Facebook that you had someone contacting you. You're like, why are they contacting me? Come on now.
Yeah, my self-esteem issues. Yeah.
I think you need a publicist, man. I think you do a bad job being like, no, I didn't write several. I only wrote three. Yeah, that's several, man.
All right.